Martha Washington. Not wise or great in any shining worldly sense was she, but largely endowed with those qualities of the heart that conspire to the making of a noble and rounded character, she was well worthy to be the chosen companion and much-loved wife of the greatest of our soldiers and the purest of our patriots, Anne Hollingsworth Wharton. On a great Virginia plantation in the year 1732, Martha Dandridge was born. Her father was a prominent landowner, and his daughter had the usual education of the time, not much schooling in comparison with today, but she learned to play the spinet, to dance gracefully, and to sew with all the mysteries of elaborate stitches. A well-behaved, pretty child she was, who at 15 made her debut in Williamsburg, the capital of Virginia, which then afforded the gayest social life in America. Dressed in a stiff bodice and flowered petticoat, Martha was the belle of the ball, and of many succeeding ones as well, for at once she became a great favorite. When she was barely 18, she married Daniel Park Custis, a wealthy landowner who was more than 20 years her senior. They lived near Williamsburg at his country home, the White House. 7 years later, he died, leaving her with two young children and a great fortune, thousands of pounds and thousands of acres of Virginia land. In May 1758, Mrs. Custis was visiting at Major Chamberlain's when her host brought an unexpected guest, none other than young Colonel George Washington, already a military hero and commander of the Virginia troops. He was en route to Williamsburg to report to the governor on the needs of his regiments, and when Major Chamberlain pressed him to stop, he had at first refused, but yielded when told that the prettiest and richest widow in all Virginia was there. He would stay for dinner then, but must go on at once, and gave orders accordingly to his servant, Bishop, bequeathed to him by General Braddock. But when dinner was over and the horses were brought round, no Washington appeared, though Bishop had never known his master to be late before. In the drawing room, the young colonel and the young widow were talking, oblivious to everything else, while the impatient steeds pawed the drive restlessly. Till the day was done and twilight at hand, Washington loitered. "No guest can leave my house after sunset," said the major, and insisted that he must stay the night. Late the next morning, Bishop and his master rode away to Williamsburg. The little widow in the white dimity frock, with the cluster of May blossoms at her belt and the little white cap half covering her soft wavy brown hair, had completely captivated the soldier. His business in the town completed, he rode on to the White House. The following day, when Washington left for camp in the Western campaign against Fort Duquesne, the two were engaged. In January 1759, when they had met just four times, Mrs. Custis and George Washington were married. A brilliant scene the wedding was. The guests included wealthy planters and their wives and daughters, all very grand in their satins and brocades, English officers in army and navy uniforms, the governor of Virginia, in scarlet embroidered, with gold, with a bag wig. Thus began their 40 years of married life. After a few months in Williamsburg, to settle the business of the Custis estate and to attend the meetings of the House of Burgesses, of which Washington had been elected a member during his campaign against the French, he took his bride to Mount Vernon, his 8,000-acre plantation on the Potomac River. Here they planned to live quietly, he busy with his fields and flocks, she with the large household, and both enjoying the growth of the Custis children. In a white apron and cap, with a bunch of keys jingling at her side, Mrs. Washington supervised the busy kitchen and slave quarters, looked after the strict training and the lessons of the children, and was a charming hostess to their guests. But public affairs changed, and with them this quiet, happy life. The Stamp Act and oppressive taxes stirred the colonies. Like many patriot women, Martha Washington ceased using tea at her table, ceased to buy English cloth and other goods of English manufacture. No less than 16 spinning wheels were kept busy at Mount Vernon, and on the looms homespun was woven for the family's clothing and for the large number of slaves. Rapidly events moved to a crisis. the first Continental Congress was called, and Washington elected as one of Virginia's three delegates. When the party started north, Mrs. Washington saw them off with these words of wifely appreciation. "I hope you will all stand firm. I know George will. God be with you, gentlemen." And this was not idle talk on her part, for she foresaw plainly the consequences. At the many discussions and debates which had occurred at their home, for and against English policy, she had said little, but had listened intelligently. She summed it up in writing to her friend, "Dark days and darker nights, domestic happiness suspended, social enjoyments abandoned, property put in jeopardy, but what are all these evils when compared with the fate of which the Port Bill may be only a threat? My mind is made up. My heart is in the cause." The Second Congress met the following May, and Washington was unanimously chosen Commander-in-Chief of the Army. He wrote this news to his wife at Mount Vernon, adding that he hoped to return in the autumn. Instead, he then invited her to come to him in Cambridge, but carefully pointed out the difficulties of the journey. Unhesitating, undismayed, a true soldier's wife, she set out for the long trip to the north, as though it were the most natural thing in the world to leave the ease and security of her southern home and spend the winter in a New England camp on the outskirts of a city held by the enemy. The coach with its four horses and postillions in white and scarlet livery attracted great attention. In the country, people rushed to doors and windows to get a sight of her. In the towns, she was met by escorts of Continental soldiers, the ringing of bells and enthusiastic cheering. With a mingled feeling of pride and wonder, this little woman, who had never been out of Virginia, realized what it was to be the wife of General Washington. This was a real farewell to the quiet plantation and the beginning of her public life. Except for the year when Trenton and Princeton and active winter campaigning made it too dangerous for women to be present, it was Martha Washington's custom to join her husband when the army went into winter quarters, and to march back home when work opened with the spring. Thus she heard the first and last gun of every campaign, and described herself as a perambulator for those 8 years. Because she was the wife of the general, it did not follow that she could live in luxury. In Cambridge, to be sure, headquarters were in the Craigie House, later the home of the poet Longfellow, and here Mrs. Washington had some social life with the wives of the Harvard professors. But in other places, lodgings were often very, very uncomfortable, a squeezed-up room or two. At Valley Forge, a log cabin was built near a Quaker farmhouse where the Washingtons had two rooms to serve as a kitchen and dining room. But when this same plan was proposed for the headquarters at Morristown, no lumber was available. At Newburgh, their inconvenient dining room had one window and seven doors, and the sitting room was so small that when Washington entertained a French officer, the guest had to sit on a camp bed. Martha Washington's presence lessened the general's cares and broke the monotony of the long, anxious winters. She was always a delightful hostess, and even with camp limitations, her hospitality and genial manner reminded her guests of Virginia. Nearly every day, some of the young officers and their wives were invited to dinner, the general and Mrs. Washington sitting side by side, while Alexander Hamilton carved. Martha Washington was always a simple, dignified woman, as a group of Morristown ladies who went to call upon her testified. Having heard that the general's wife was a very grand lady, they wore their best bibs and bands and most elegant silks and ruffles. Mrs. Washington, in a plain homespun dress and a specked checked apron, received them very graciously, a half-knit stocking in her left hand, the ball of yarn in her pocket. After the usual compliments were over, she resumed her knitting. "And there we were," described one of the women afterward, "without a stitch of work and sitting in state, but General Washington's lady was knitting socks." She showed them two dresses of cotton and silk woven at Mount Vernon, the stripes made from ravelings of brown silk stockings and old crimson damask chair covers. She took pains to tell them that the livery of her coachman was all homespun, save for the scarlet cuffs made of English material imported long before the war. After that visit, work for the soldiers, rather than fine feminine clothes, became the fashion in Morristown. At another New Jersey headquarters, Washington was staying at a private house, whose mistress one day saw a coach drive up to the door with 10 dragoons as the escort. Out stepped a plain little woman dressed in brown homespun, wearing a hood. Over her bosom was folded a large white kerchief. She must be a maid, thought the hostess, until she saw General Washington greeting her and inquiring about the children and his favorite horses at Mount Vernon. The general's wife, dressed like that. Everywhere the soldiers loved Lady Washington, as they called her. During the sad winter at Valley Forge, when the army was in desperate straits, suffering greatly from lack of food and blankets and clothing, and the consequent constant sickness, she went to share the soldiers' privations and make a spot of cheer in their dreary lives. She arrived in a rough farm sleigh, hired from the innkeeper at the Forks of the Brandywine, where the deep snow had forced her to abandon her coach. Staunch patriot that she was, she made light of inconveniences and discomforts and hardships, and never was a woman busier than Martha Washington all that dismal winter. In a cloak and hood, with her basket on her arm, she went in the deep snow from hut to hut, carrying delicacies for the sick and consolation for the dying, and by her sympathy and generosity, stimulating the loyalty and courage of the men. "God bless Lady Washington," was frequently heard when her kind, motherly face appeared. Day after day she assembled in her two rooms the wives of the officers to knit and patch and make new garments whenever materials could be secured. No more embroidering and spinet playing and other light accomplishments. The work these women did at Valley Forge was far-reaching in its effect. News of it spread to Philadelphia, where the British were having a gay winter, and the patriotic ladies there commenced making shirts for the soldiers, and ultimately contributed nearly 3,000 garments. Small in amount, perhaps, in comparison with such service today, but Martha Washington was a pioneer, anticipating the work of the Sanitary Commission and the American Red Cross. Officers, soldiers, and women, all were steadied by her serenity and unwavering faith. And when the middle of March brought better times, she led in the camp gaiety. The news of the French alliance was celebrated with a grand review. The soldiers cheered for the King of France, for the 13 states, for their general. And then there came shouts of "Long live Lady Washington," and 1,000 hats were tossed into the air in the excitement. Yorktown and victory, and the end of the war in sight, but Washington must remain on duty until peace was actually signed. Martha Washington was present, sitting in the gallery of the old Capitol at Annapolis, when he resigned his commission, and together they drove to Mount Vernon, arriving on Christmas Eve. Standing at the door of his cottage to welcome them was old Bishop, dressed in the scarlet regimentals he had worn at Braddock's defeat. All the servants and slaves assembled, and such a Christmas celebration as Mount Vernon had. More than all else, the Washingtons longed for quiet days on their plantation to enjoy the rest they so much needed. But there were guests innumerable, so that Mount Vernon was described as a well-resorted tavern. When he had been home almost 2 years, Washington wrote in his diary, "Dined with only Mrs. Washington," which I believe is the first instance of it since my retirement from public life. This furlough, as the general used to speak of it, was not destined to continue over long. The Federation of the States proved too weak a government, and Washington must go to Philadelphia for months to sit as president of the Constitutional Convention. Then, after the people had ratified the Constitution, there came one day riding up the broad drive at Mount Vernon the aged Secretary of Congress with a letter notifying George Washington that he had been elected President of the United States. "I little thought when the war was finished," wrote Martha Washington, "that any circumstances could possibly have happened which would call the general into public life again. I had anticipated that we should have been left to grow old in solitude and tranquility together. That was the first and dearest wish of my heart. Yet I cannot blame him for having acted according to his ideas of duty in obeying the voice of his country. Alone to New York for the inauguration went George Washington, wearing a homespun suit woven at Mount Vernon. When his wife, likewise dressed in homespun, followed a few weeks later, her welcome all along the journey was second only to his. She entered many a town between two long columns of revolutionary soldiers, and at New York City she was rowed across the bay by 13 oarsmen dressed in white, while the guns fired 13 rounds and crowds cheered her. As the president's wife, Martha Washington was hostess for the nation, entertaining distinguished citizens and foreigners, cabinet officers and congressmen, presiding at the state dinners and giving public receptions every Friday, where plum cake, tea, and coffee were served. The guests were always dismissed before 9 with her grave, frank little formula. For the general always retires at 9, and I usually precede him. The need over, she laid aside her homespun and dressed in silk, satin, velvet, and lace, as became the wife of the president. People criticized Mrs. Washington for the ceremony in force at her levees, saying they were too much like those of royalty. Guests were shocked because they had to stand, while the truth was the rooms would not have contained a third enough chairs. Presided over by the Washingtons, the executive mansion combined with the most ardent patriotism a dignity and elegant moderation that would have honored any European court. They saved the social life of a new country from both the crudeness and bald simplicity of extreme republicanism, and from the luxury and excesses often marking sudden elevation to power and place. And in all these social functions, Mrs. Washington never joined in any political discussion. Though the letters between her and her husband were filled with talk of public affairs, she was never once heard to utter any opinion on important questions of state. And in this, as in many details of her life, she is a worthy model for any American woman whose husband is in public service. The year in New York was followed by similar years in Philadelphia, after the Capitol was moved there. The second term of the presidency over and a third term refused, the Washingtons gladly returned to Virginia, their joy being evidenced in this letter. I cannot tell you how much I enjoy home, after having been deprived of one so long, for our dwelling in New York and Philadelphia was not home, only sojourning. The general and I feel like children just released from school or from a hard taskmaster, and we believe that nothing can tempt us to leave the sacred roof tree again, except on private business or pleasure. I am fairly settled down to the pleasant duties of an old-fashioned Virginia housekeeper, steady as a clock, busy as a bee, and cheerful as a cricket. Happily, they lived at Mount Vernon 2 years until the general's death. During his brief illness, Mrs. Washington never left his room. "'Tis well," were his last words. "Is he dead?" she asked, so gentle had been the change. "'Tis well. All is over now. I shall soon follow him. I have no more trials to pass through." She moved up to a little attic room whose window looked out over his grave and beyond to the waters of the Potomac, which he had so loved. Surrounded by her grandchildren and great-grandchildren, cheerful in her sorrow and loneliness, she survived him 2 years and, when she died, was buried beside him in the simple brick tomb at Mount Vernon. A woman not wise nor great, perhaps in any worldly sense, Martha Washington had those qualities of heart that make a noble, rounded character, a devoted and loyal wife, a tender mother, an earnest Christian. She was fitted to be the chosen companion of the greatest of our soldiers and the purest of our patriots. Serene and kindly, in the familiar white cap and kerchief, she has become the nation's ideal of the president's wife, our country's first hostess.